WBUR.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Argentina gets the lion's share of attention. Colombia has more guns and drugs. But those two are not the only South American countries in turmoil. Look at Venezuela. In April, President Hugo Chavez was briefly ousted in a bloody coup, then restored to power 2 days later, still talking revolution. In this hour, rich, poor, and ready to rumble in Venezuela. We begin tonight in Jerusalem, where CIA Director George Tenet has arrived to promote an overhaul of the Palestinian security forces. Earlier, I spoke with Joel Greenberg of the New York Times Jerusalem Bureau and asked him what the CIA chief hopes to accomplish and what situation he's stepping into.
He's got a fairly ambitious goal and a very difficult situation that he's walking into. The goal is to try to start a revamping of the Palestinian security forces in a way that will improve security for Israelis and prevent suicide bombings, and also improve their own internal accountability. The problem is that he's coming into an atmosphere of deep distrust between the two parties, and despite the end of an Israeli offensive in April throughout the West Bank, there's still many military incursions, and the atmosphere between the two sides is highly suspicious, and he's going to have to work very hard to get the parties to agree on any kind of security plan.
Let's look first at the Palestinians. Is there openness in the Palestinian community to actually create a security unit that is there in part to defend Israelis?
It's a difficult proposition for the Palestinians because they want this coupled with political progress. In other words, they're willing to work on security, but for them, this has to be coupled with prospects for Israeli withdrawal from territory that can later form the basis of a Palestinian state. They don't see the point of being Israel's policemen with no diplomatic gains. That's as far as the Palestinians are concerned.
And as for the Israelis, do they have any hope that George Tenet can turn the Palestinian security forces into a line of defense for them?
The Israelis are going into this. The Sharon government is very skeptical that anything can happen as long as Yasser Arafat is the head of the Palestinian Authority. Mr. Sharon has very much personalized this issue and pointed his finger directly at Mr. Arafat, saying that there are other people in the Palestinian Authority he could do business with, but that he doesn't feel any progress can be made with Mr. Arafat. Now, the American position has been that Mr. Arafat is the elected leader of the Palestinians, and he is there and has to be dealt with. So this is one of the issues that George Tenet is going to have to work on with the parties. So it's a tall order, and it's a difficult agenda, but you have to start somewhere.
Meanwhile, as he arrives, Israeli forces are in a number of locations in the West Bank. How heavy is the Israeli troop presence there today compared to the height of the incursion a month and more ago?
Well, the Israelis are now conducting what they call rolling incursions. In other words, every few days they'll go into another city in the West Bank, round up people for questioning, look for explosives, blow up explosives if they do find them. Right now they're in the largest West Bank city, Nablus. They're there for the fourth day running. They've been rounding up people, taking them out of their houses, blindfolded, questioning them. Most have been released and others are being held for questioning. But these rolling military operations have not been suspended in advance of the Tenet visit, and no one expects them to stop as long as there are suicide attacks inside Israel.
You've written that it in effect is blurring the lines of what's Palestinian and what's Israeli-controlled territory all over the West Bank.
Yes. In fact, there's been a new reality created. According to the original Oslo Agreement from 1993 between Israel and the Palestinians, the Israelis withdrew from certain areas of the West Bank, the Palestinian cities, and these became areas of Palestinian control, including Palestinian security control. The idea was that they would take charge of security in their areas, as the areas that Israel pulled out of, and work together with the Israeli security forces on keeping the peace. That situation has broken down completely, and now the Israelis have basically taken it upon themselves to work inside those Palestinian cities to combat what they see as the hotbeds of terrorist attacks against Israelis. So Israel has basically taken over security responsibility by force, if you will, inside the Palestinian areas. The Palestinians say that with Israel attacking their security forces and limiting their movement, they can't be expected to do the work they're supposed to under the agreements. So you have a stalemate, in a way, where the Israelis are pushing in and the Palestinians are saying, as long as you're in here, we can't do our job.
Meanwhile, suicide bombings have gone on, do the Israelis believe that they're making progress, even though these terrorist attacks continue?
There was a lull during the large-scale military offensive in April, but that has quickly ended. As soon as Israeli forces ended those incursions, it was almost predictable that these militant groups would reorganize and again try to send attackers inside Israel, and there have been several very serious attacks since. There have been five in all since the Israeli incursions ended. I'm talking about suicide bombings. The key, I think, to ending all this is to restore some measure of security cooperation and trust between the parties. And that brings us back to Tenet's visit. I think that what the CIA director is going to try to rebuild here is some kind of dialogue between a revamped Palestinian security system and the Israeli security chiefs. It seems that only if they work together can these attacks stop. Unilateral Israeli military action can only bring temporary relief, but no long-term results.
And what about Yasser Arafat? Will George Tenet meet him? Could it be that he's there talking to other Palestinians who might take a more forceful role in providing security?
No, the plan is that Mr. Tenet will meet with Mr. Arafat after meeting with Prime Minister Sharon, which is a meeting going on today. And he will deal directly with him. The hope from the American side is that Mr. Arafat will put into place people that will head up a newly formed security force that will work together with the Americans and the Israelis on some kind of security arrangements that will first bring about a ceasefire and then start perhaps a pullback of Israeli forces from areas they've taken over, trying to build toward a resumption of negotiations. So Arafat will definitely be in the picture, but I think the Americans are hoping that it will be Arafat at the head of a reformed security network.
Joel Greenberg, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Joel Greenberg is a reporter with the New York Times. He spoke to us from Jerusalem. In Venezuela, you either love him or loathe him. Either way, President Hugo Chavez has been shaking things up since he swept into office in 1999 by the largest margin of victory in the country's electoral history. Venezuela's poor embrace him as a savior. The rich deride him as a dangerous demagogue. In April, Chavez was briefly ousted and arrested by an alliance of generals and business powers in a coup that killed 17 and wounded hundreds. Washington raised no objection to the coup. In a revealing portrait of Chavez in Sunday's New York Times magazine, tonight's guest, Deborah Sontag, describes Venezuela's president as a shock therapist who has exposed and exploited profound class divisions in Venezuelan society, inequities he has made impossible to ignore. Can social revolution and democracy coexist in Venezuela? Why did Washington watch so calmly as a democratically elected leader was toppled, however briefly, in Latin America? What's the fire that's burning now in Venezuela? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from Brooklyn, New York is Deborah Sontag. Good evening and welcome.
Thank you.
Nice piece on Sunday. With us also from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Deborah Sontag, what is it about Hugo Chavez? You described some wonderful scenes in your story, but at heart, what is it about him that is so upsetting to Venezuela's upper crust?
Well, perhaps it's his power. he is an extremely charismatic leader who is kind of a throwback to 60s revolutionary ideas, but a somewhat inept leader. And so he's given, in a positive sense, he's given voice to the poor there who've been largely excluded from the political system for a long time. But in a somewhat, a very divisive and polarizing way, he's done it by inflaming their resentment, which was sort of lingering beneath the surface of their lives anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing so, he hasn't, you know, healthily empowered them. He's empowered them without delivering an improvement in their lives and in a way that's made them very hostile and vengeful feeling toward the moneyed classes in Venezuela.
So expectations and passions are up. Why, as you call him, a 60s throwback now in Venezuela?
Well, I think it was because the democratic system, as solid as it really was in Venezuela since the last coup, which was in 1958, had been kind of corrupted by two political parties that had traded the reins and the spoils of power for a long time. And the elite had basically absented themselves from the political process and concentrated on making money and getting rich. And, you know, the things were not improving for the lives of the bulk of Venezuelans there. And so when Chavez came along and spoke about giving them a place, giving them a voice, giving them a life, they embraced him, and there was absolutely no opposition. There were no other charismatic leaders in Venezuela.
Mm-hmm. You've spent time, some time with the Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez. Describe him for us. What does he look like, sound like? What kind of energy does he fill a room with? Where's he come from?
Well, I saw him, you know, 2 weeks after he was restored to power. And so, you know, I don't know that he was his complete self at that point, because mm-hmm. he was still pretty shaken up and his hold on power was very tenuous, as it still is. But I had a taxi driver who took me to his residence for the radio show that he was giving right after he was restored to power. And the guy was a computer technician who was out of work and had been forced to drive a cab, and he was very anti-Chavez. And he spent the entire time driving me there warning me that I should not succumb to the charm of Hugo Chavez.
Don't be taken in.
He said, you know, I listen to him and I have to, you know, hit myself in the head to keep from falling under his sway. And there's a naturalness to Chavez, a kind of unabashed stream of consciousness flow that comes out of him that makes everyone who listens to him feel as if they're being brought into his intimate thoughts. And he speaks a good game. I mean, he's just extremely a colorful speaker and a very human speaker, and his ideas seem, you know, he's very well-meaning.
Only a few years before he was elected president, he was actually part of a coup plot, an attempted coup himself.
Indeed, and it was in 1992, and he was in the military then, and he was part of a kind of revolutionary brigade that was somewhat secret within the military, and they thought the power structure was corrupt, and they attempted a coup, and it was a total failure. But somehow, and this was the first glimpse that Venezuela had of his charm and his power, he managed to turn an utter failure into a personal success for himself, because he had one moment on national television to persuade his comrades to lay down their arms as the coup was ending in a bloodbath for them. And he managed to turn on his charisma and, you know, come across as someone who would be back. And indeed, he did return.
And indeed, he is. Jack Beatty, this is in very broad outline. This is a story, whether or not we followed Venezuela recently, that we feel like we know in Latin America. Military man with some charisma who comes on the scene and shakes things up.
We sure do. I was thinking of Juan Perón just listening to this in Argentina. There's a famous anecdote about Perón. Someone said to one of his followers, well, you're poor. And he said, yes, before Perón, I was poor. After Perón, I'm still poor, but I'm somebody. He had that feeling of saying, of justifying people's grievances and saying, you're right to feel your grievance. You're right to feel these things. You're justified. I guess the question with leaders like this is, can they produce? Can this man produce with, as you point out in your article, the capital flight that is going on in Venezuela with people with money going out of the country?
Deborah Suntuck, has he made progress so far? We've heard Washington say no.
No. You know, that doesn't mean he should be ousted in a coup, but he hasn't been able to deliver on his promises. I would say that the only thing that he has accomplished is a somewhat important rhetorical and political shift in which the poor have been given a place in the political structure of society, and that will probably never change. I mean, I don't think people will ever accept again being marginalized as they were for a good deal of the last 50 years. Mm-hmm. But it's not just that there's been intense capital flight. He's really bungled his economic moves. He's over-concentrated Venezuela's dependency on oil. And I won't bore you with the other details.
We'll come back to that. There's a lot we want to know about Hugo Chavez. and the boiling pot in Venezuela, can democracy and social revolution coexist in Venezuela? Can the United States support real change in the country? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the boiling pot in Venezuela. President Hugo Chavez there was tossed out in a coup only a couple of months ago. He is back. Why was the United States so ready to support the April coup? And is Hugo Chavez wrong to whip up Venezuelan passions over social and economic inequities, or is that a leader's job? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by New York Times Sunday Magazine writer Deborah Sontag, and now by Moises Naim. He's editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. He's a former trade and industry minister of Venezuela. Good evening and welcome, Moises Naim.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. We've heard some of the picture from Deborah Sontag of the personality of Hugo Chavez, but what are the underlying circumstances in economic terms, in sociological terms, that have built the platform for him to stand on?
Venezuela is a resource-rich country, and most of the resources are owned by the state. Therefore, most Venezuelans, or every Venezuelan, are told since they are born and go to primary education that they are very wealthy, that because the country has natural resources and the natural resources belong to the state, it's theirs. And what in reality happens is that in the last 20 years, every year and every day, daily life has become poorer and the wealth is nowhere to be seen. So that is the essential explanation that most Venezuelans have for what's happening to them is somebody stole my wealth. And corruption is a centerpiece of this, and resentment. So anybody that is poor thinks that anybody that is rich is wealthy because it stole their what's theirs, not because of hard work. And so there's a lot of simmering and long-standing resentment that Hugo Chavez has exploited very effectively.
And do you see him then, if there's that much resentment, as a kind of a natural democratic response to that sentiment?
One of the problem is that theory is not true. Venezuela is not a wealthy country. Venezuela today is a very poor country. Venezuela essentially is a country that lacks institutions, lacks human capital, lacks all sorts of possibilities and characteristics of a wealthy, rich country that can be part of the global economy or can provide prosperity to its citizens. And it is the lack of economic policies, it's the lack of good economic policy that has created this situation. And Hugo Chavez is certainly not presenting an option and to create prosperity, and that is what is creating the instability and the political instability that we are now witnessing.
You say he's not creating options for prosperity.
No.
But yet you describe this fictional wealth of the country, a kind of magical realism interpretation of what's going on there. We see that same kind of model in Argentina, where there's not a full coming to grips sometimes with underlying economic realities. Why?
Well, what is now very clear is that resource-rich countries have a harder time developing and becoming capable of providing what their citizens need. Look at very resource-poor countries like Taiwan, for example, or Singapore, and compare it to countries like Nigeria or some countries in Africa or some countries like Venezuela with oil or Argentina with a huge agricultural wealth. That stifles economic incentives, distorts the economy, and makes for a horrible political system.
Were the political parties that Hugo Chavez came in and blew out of the water in the election, were they doing something constructive about this? Why did it take an ex-military man, an ex-coup plotter, to come in and start talking so loudly about these problems in Venezuela?
There is no doubt that the parties that had ruled Venezuela for 40 years were corrupt, deeply corrupt. They were incompetent, and they were blindsided by the oil wealth. It is also true that anybody in power in Venezuela during the last 40 years or so would have suffered the political backlash of a country that believes itself to be very wealthy, and it's not. Let me give you just a number. In 1980, oil provided about $2,000 per head for each Venezuelan. This year is going to be about $150. So that decline in the fiscal capabilities of the state, meaning the capacity, the money that...
Did you say from $2,000 to $100?
Yeah.
Why oil prices have not fallen that far?
Well, but oil production has not kept up, and population has grown, and you know, in today's oil capacity in Venezuela is to the levels of 1990 because of lack of investment. And one of the things that Hugo Chavez has done is to essentially cripple the oil industry financially, operationally, managerially. And he essentially took out what was a very respected class of managers in the state-owned enterprise and fired 300-400 top managers and replaced them with his cronies that are essentially destroying the oil industry and Venezuela's capability to export.
And we know that was an important spark that set in motion the things that led to the April coup. Were you surprised that he came back? Now that he's there, what do you imagine is going to happen? You have a democratically elected, charismatic leader in a difficult economic situation. How do you think this is going to play out?
Well, the situation is terrible in a variety of ways. The economic situation is very difficult. The government is running out of money. Essentially, the government is not capable of even meeting its payroll obligations. And the country is deeply, deeply divided. The armed forces are divided. And the country faces a very profound governance problem that the solution is not clear.
Moises Naim, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Moises Naim is editor of Foreign Policy magazine. We're talking about the boiling pot in Venezuela. Is Hugo Chavez wrong to whip up Venezuelan passions over social and economic inequities? Or is that a leader's job? And if it is a leader's job, is he doing the job? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Siddiqui is on the line. Welcome, Siddiqui. You're on
Good
the
evening.
Air.
How are you?
Fine.
Yeah, I've been interested in the conversation tonight. First, I find it interesting that the United States has been portrayed as an interested observer in this whole process, when the reality is that it's fairly known fact that the CIA was directly involved in the coup that failed. And essentially what it is that the United States, of course, concerned with Venezuela being the third most important oil producer for this country. So they're very concerned about this individual Chavez, who in fact says he's nationalizing everything. And also, when I hear the reports about the country being split, well, yes, it is split. It's the wealthy, which are the huge minority, versus the poor, who support Chavez, who's saying that I'm going to make the resources work for the people. So it's a very common occurrence out here, where you find that the split, the reason why the economy is in trouble over there is because the wealthy there have sucked the guts out of the economy to make themselves rich, and the masses have suffered. And so the masses say, hey, we've got someone we can identify with that wants to do for us.
Siddiqui, thanks for your call. Let me put it to Deborah Sontag. Thank you for calling. Deborah Sontag, how about it? First of all, what is the word that you heard here on the streets in Venezuela about the U.S. role or lack of role in the April coup? And then how do the poor and the wealthy at this point see Chavez?
Well, on the first question, I found it very interesting, especially as a former Middle East reporter, where whenever you'd venture into the streets of Jerusalem or Ramallah or Gaza, you would hear a lot of commentary from people about the role of the United States. In Venezuela, this was not the preoccupation of, you know, your Chavez supporter or your anti-Chavez person. They were just not thinking a lot about the U.S. role. I think there was a presumption, it's certainly not a fact, that there was strong, that there was CIA involvement. There is more than a presumption that there was governmental encouragement of the forces that were operating to remove Chavez in whatever way.
U.S. governmental encouragement, are you saying?
U.S. governmental encouragement, yeah.
And certainly there was no protest from Washington after the coup.
Well, just the opposite.
And what about Our caller Siddiqui was pointing to the divide between rich and poor. You present an interesting portrayal of how he's seen by each of those groups in your article. I guess it's more or less what we might expect from the poor, to whom he has such a great appeal. But you also found a kind of grudging, would respect be the right word, among the rich, or a sense of inevitability about someone like him coming along?
I found amongst some of the more members of the intelligentsia, say, in the elite, a more nuanced impression of him than I would have expected, in that several of them seemed to be saying to me that we were destined to have Hugo Chavez, that he is playing an important historical role in our country, in that we had become distanced from our country, and he has woken us all up. He has woken up the poor, and that's a good thing, and he has woken up the wealthy who have neglected their civic duties and the role that they used to play in society. And that it was, you know, he's just, one man put it to me, a psychiatrist actually, that Venezuela is in its adolescence. And Chavez can be seen as a kind of experimentation on the part of the country, like teenagers experiment with drugs, Venezuela is experimenting with Hugo Chavez.
This is a large-scale experiment.
Like he's something we have to go through in order to mature.
Tell us the story of the couple who got caught in one of the poor, this is a wealthy couple, caught in one of the poor barrios of Caracas, I guess, when passions were inflamed about what was going on with Chavez. Fascinating story.
Yeah, this was quite a moving story. It was right after the coup. It was right before Chavez was actually restored to power. A wealthy industrialist's wife had been in Paris, and she wanted to return home to be with her family because the events were so unstable. She flew in. Her husband personally went to meet her at the airport, and in order to return to Caracas, to the wealthy neighborhoods up in the hills, you have to pass by the very large, poor, pro-Chavez barrio of Catia. And when they got to the Catia area, there were roadblocks, there were tires on fire, there were thousands and thousands and thousands of very angry Chavez supporters in the street, and they had to abandon their car and proceed on foot. And they were trying to snake their way through alleyways and be a little bit incognito. The woman actually darkened her face with makeup. She has blonde hair that she hid under a hat. She pulled her blouse out, but they were recognizable for who they were. They looked to be of a different class. And at a certain point, a kind of mob of people began descending on them, you know, yelling oligarchs, as they call them, you know, rich people, murderers, assassins. And they really were, you know, getting more and more nervous. And an old woman came up to this man and said, "I know who you are. You are Mr. Such and Such." And the name is very famous in Venezuela as a rich person's name. And he was trembling.
A kind of a Rockefeller name.
Exactly. And he was trembling. I mean, streets and buildings are named after this man's family. And she said, she identified herself as the daughter of the man who had been his father's barber for decades. And she said, "Come with me, I will keep you safe. I'm a Chavista, I'm pro-Chavez, but you can't be out in this." And she took this couple, who are like, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Rockefeller, into a very, very humble shack in this poor barrio, and they ended up spending the night there because it was too dangerous for them to go outside. And over the course of that night, they discovered that this family, whose existence they really didn't know about, had an entire bookshelf devoted to the history of their family.
And so they were saved by their teeth, by the barber of the man's father, by the skin of their teeth. Jack Beatty, I guess this is when a rich man knows that his country has not paid enough attention to democracy and perhaps equality, when he's chased down in a suburb of his own city.
King Lear on the Heath, you know, take physic, Pomp, and see what the world is like. But of course, the Lear line to shake down the superflux and show the world more just. The terrible thing about an underdeveloped country is that there's so little superflux. to shake down. I mean, there are the rich, and there are, they have their money, but they can leave with it. And this extractive economy makes it very hard to have a more equitable distribution of goods, although almost anything would be more equitable than what they have, which strikes me as a kind of, warning to America. When you don't have a middle class, when you have an 80-20 society, this is what you get.
Deborah Sontag, Jack, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation now Julia Zweig. She's Senior Fellow and Deputy Director of Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Good evening and welcome, Julia Zweig.
Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you. You have made some rather dire predictions about what may unfold in Venezuela. How serious is the problem there? How badly could things go wrong? And what does it mean for the hemisphere, I guess?
Well, I have predicted that another coup or some sort of major violent political upheaval could happen at any moment. And that's because, as the other guests have noted, the polarization in Venezuela is very, very striking. And it seems to me that neither the hardcore of the Chavista movement within the government and their supporters, nor the opposition have climbed down from the extreme positions where they were in the days and weeks leading up to April 11th.
Are you talking about a political polarization or economic polarization?
Well, it is, of course, as Moises said, it is fed by the economic polarization, but it is also a political polarization where the forces behind the coup or multiple coups that were unfolding in the month of April, the opposition forces behind that coup are still very much committed to getting Chavez out, and Chavez himself and his government are very much committed to continuing their tenure in power, for which they were, of course, democratically elected.
Do you foresee a potential split in the country as along the lines we've seen in Colombia next door?
Well, it's not a good comparison. However, what is a relevant comparison is how elites in both Venezuela and in Colombia are waking up to the enormous messes that they have wrought by, as your colleague said, allowing in both countries, our resource-rich countries, allowing such an unequal distribution of wealth and such a frozen political party system to prevail for so many decades.
You call Hugo Chavez a living martyr. What do you mean by that, and what are the political consequences of that?
Well, the coup, and I think Deborah's article noted this as well, has strengthened him. He has now 10 points higher and has went up from about 20% to 45% in polling ratings after the coup. And he has put himself before the Venezuelan population as their savior, as their Bolivar. And I had a very strong sense that were Chavez to die, to be killed either through a coup or to be removed somehow from the political landscape there, that the Chavista movement would be even stronger in his absence.
Deborah Sontag, do you share that sense?
Absolutely.
That means there's no escaping Hugo Chavez, even if he's ousted or killed.
Without a doubt. And what I also want to add to the question about the fragility of the moment in Venezuela now is the military, which had both removed Chavez from power and put him back in.
Meaning it split itself.
And it is internally divided, and it is in many different directions, but there are rumors flying, and it's hard to know which of them are real and credible, but it seems to be that the next 6 weeks will be crucial. In the beginning of July, you're going to have promotions. There are many junior officers that feel that people are being promoted.
Deborah Sontag, stand by. We've got to take a short break. Please stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back. Can democracy and social revolution coexist in Venezuela? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Hugo Chavez and the boiling pot in Venezuela. Can the United States afford to support change, social reform in Venezuela? Can it afford not to? Why was the U.S. so ready to support the April coup against Hugo Chavez? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Deborah Sontag. She's a staff writer with the New York Times Sunday Magazine, by Julia Zweig, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Benjamin is on the line. Welcome, Benjamin. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Tom. My point is that
very, very in support of what Hugo Chavez is doing in Venezuela until we realize that no democracy can thrive under the corrupt practices, or rather on a very corrupt foundation. Until we realize that, then we will start to support Hugo Chavez. If he has to involve a 10-year or 4 years of economic downturn, but in the long run, it's going to benefit the Venezuelan people.
Are you Venezuelan, Benjamin?
I am not, but I come from a country with a similar situation, which is Nigeria. Mm-hmm. I'm telling you, the same people, the same corrupt practices is still going on, despite the so-called democracy that is existing in Nigeria. You go over there and see this squalor, see the destruction of every facility, and nobody's paying attention to that. Mm-hmm. All we are concerned with is the democracy, no matter under which the condition is operating.
We got it. So here's a vote of fellow feeling from Nigeria. Julia Swag, what about the U.S. role in all this? What should the U.S. do? There's the obvious sentiment out of Washington is not very friendly to Hugo Chavez. Does that mean that Washington is against reform in Venezuela?
Not at all. I think that Washington needs to go back to the Clinton-era policy toward Chavez in Venezuela, which was to not get drawn into pissing matches over rhetoric with Venezuela, and to have a relationship with the Venezuelan government, with the Chavez government, perhaps at arm's length. But what the Bush administration, especially since September 11th, has done, and Chavez has provoked it indeed also, is to isolate Venezuela, isolate Chavez, and to deny him the kind of legitimacy that other democratically elected governments get in Latin America for pure, I think, rhetorical and ideological reasons. Granted, his style of reform, in addition to which the fact that it hasn't succeeded, is provocative because he has opened up this uncorked a genie's bottle. Class conflict is palpable in the air, and in a world in which the United States stands for globalization and free trade and markets, Chavez is bucking the system. His association with Fidel Castro is very unpopular. His attacks against the air war in Afghanistan were not taken well in Washington, but nonetheless, he is in fact a democratically elected leader, and we need, I think, to stop the isolation and reach out at a very high level to that government. That on the question of the coup, I think there's no doubt that we were giving tea and sympathy to opposition figures. And those people in Venezuela understood that to mean that we would look the other way were they to succeed with a coup. But I don't know of evidence yet, and eventually it will, of course, be uncovered, of CIA-specific management of the coup. You could even make the case that the coup might have succeeded had the CIA been involved in it.
It certainly didn't look very effective.
It was pretty Abbott and Costello stuff.
Mm. Bob is on the line. Welcome, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could comment on this. There's a story reported in the British press, was a reputable source, I forget if it was the BBC or something like that, that Chavez had been tipped off by a phone call from OPEC, where because there might have been another oil embargo, and because Venezuela would have been an important part of that one side or the other,
mm-hmm.
Someone had tipped them off that there would be a coup, and what they did was very clever, which was to leave a bunch of their Marines in the presidential palace.
You mean Chavez kept Marines around him?
In the presidential palace, not around him.
Uh-huh.
In the palace, which then, when it was taken over, right, and he was captured, he was able to call the interim president and say, give it up, because basically it was surrounded from the outside and, you know, taken over from the inside.
So he had soldiers still inside because OPEC gave him a heads up. Julia Swag, does that figure to you?
No, I haven't heard that, and I've been following him pretty closely. The National Guard, the Praetorian Guard, which is typically, historically, very loyal to a sitting president, was there in the palace. But I know nothing of an OPEC tip-off whatsoever.
Sean is on the line. Welcome, Sean. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question. I know Chavez has been said that he is a democratically elected leader.
Well, more than that, he was elected.
But hasn't he undermined I want to know if he's still a legitimate democratically elected leader, and that I believe he's violated the Constitution, and I think it's his term limits, and also threatened to take back privately owned coastal land.
Deborah Sontag, he, of course, there have been changes to the Constitution, but are those seen as outside the law?
Well, I mean, he appointed a... There's a constitutional assembly that wrote a new constitution for Venezuela. Now, the constitutional assembly was granted packed with Chavez supporters, including his wife and his brother. Mm-hmm. However, the constitution was put to a poll. It was put to a referendum, and it was overwhelmingly approved by voters.
Mm-hmm.
So Venezuela now has a new constitution, its first new one since 1960-something. But it was... I mean, it's for real.
It was done legally. And though people may oppose him and his policies, is there much talk in Venezuela about his legitimacy as leader of the country?
Absolutely.
Well, this is what Sean's suggesting, that perhaps he's not a legitimate...
He's making mistakes, and he's unpopular for those very serious mistakes that he is making, and he is...
But that's a different thing than questioning the legitimacy of his election or of his residing in the president's office. He was elected. Are people questioning that somehow?
Oh, sure. People are questioning the concentration of executive power. They're questioning the fact that the Supreme Court is stacked with his supporters, as is the National Assembly, although less so. They're questioning the appointment of key figures at other figures in the judiciary.
So his exercise of authority is getting plenty of questioning. Julia Zweig, do you see open issues of legitimacy here that could lead a coup or someone from outside to come in and say Chavez doesn't deserve to sit in this seat, not on policy lines, but on purely issues of electoral legitimacy?
Well, that was the case, I think, that some in the U.S. government and others in Venezuela were trying to make, that because his... Although democratically elected, he's not governing in a legitimate way, and therefore he needs to be somehow tamed. Now, I think you're talking about the question of an outside role, such as that for the OAS, to mediate mm-hmm. somehow between the government and the opposition. That may be an effective tool, though interestingly, both the government and the opposition could interpret it as a way of strengthening the other, especially if the United States has a large role. The United States, which is seen as not an independent neutral player, has a large role in that mediation. There is an alternative, which is to have a revocatory referendum, to pass legislation in the National Assembly, which would allow for a referendum next year. The opposition seems to be very impatient in doing the politics that it would require to put that sort of thing together. But that is, I think, the peaceful way forward.
There's so much more to know.
If they were to do that, they would also build a genuine opposition, because if, you know, things were to proceed in a more abrupt manner right now, there's not really a leadership to lead the country.
Deborah Sontag, we're out of time, and I'm sorry for it. There's so much more to know. Deborah Sontag is a staff writer with the New York Times Magazine. Thank you for joining us. And Julia Zweig, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
In a moment, remembering Flora Lewis. This is On Point. Foreign correspondent and global interpreter extraordinaire Flora Lewis died Sunday at her home in Paris. She was 79. Ms. Lewis was a rare observer of foreign affairs, rare early on as a woman in what had been a man's role, and rare always in her commitment and her insights. She wrote for many of American's top newspapers and magazines. In 1972, she joined the New York Times in Paris as its bureau chief and went on to become the paper's foreign affairs columnist. Her weekly columns brought the world home to America, sometimes with laughter, sometimes with stern warnings for a country that often preferred to leave the world outside its borders. Flora Lewis filed her last column for the New York Times on December 29th, 1990. In this remembrance, her former colleague, but no relation, Anthony Lewis, reads that column entitled People Make History.
The old idea was that history was about kings and popes and wars. People, yes, but only the few who held dazzling power. Their foibles, their ruses, and their determination seemed decisive, regardless of anybody else. Then came Marx, arguing that history was made by economics, the relations of production determining winners and losers. Later, Fernand Braudel focused on geography, climate, the outside factors that require accommodation for survival. One way or another, these approaches made the story of society a juggernaut beyond the capacity of most people to direct. They could only submit or try somehow to escape. The most insidious feature of ideology is the claim to certainty, whether based on scientific logic, as the communists pretended, or for the fundamentalists on revelation. It offers no choice, excluding all other views as wrong or evil. It is a Procrustean hubris, proclaiming, "I have made the perfect bed for your repose. If you don't fit, it's your fault, and you must be chopped or racked until you do." Still, the appeal of such theses must be recognized. They respond to a deep human yearning for certitude, affirmation of perfectibility. They suggest that it is possible to remove all social and human flaws, to remake not just the world but man himself, if the command for obedience is accepted. The temptation brings disaster. Inspiration is always needed, but when it leads to belief in the right to dictate, it loses touch with humane reality. Responsibility is transferred from the individual to the abstraction, and the visionary end justifies all means. This growing awareness lies behind the collapse of communism and the renewed rise of nationalism. More and more people are coming to realize that they can choose their history. What is neither immutable nor inevitable. That is why these times are so stirring, so exciting for the journalist, whose job is to find out what people are up to and what is on their minds. The scene keeps getting bigger and more crowded. There is no end of rich lodes to probe. Leaders still matter, of course, in one sense more than ever, because they are more visible and accessible, and curiosity can be better slaked. But in another sense, they matter less because they can be challenged. The limits that surround even towering figures can be seen, bringing them back to human size. The journalist in the wings of events, watching both the performers and the audience, notices this perhaps more than most. There is such a thing as greatness, but reverence is inappropriate because one can see the warts and has to tell about them or betray the vocation to the task of myth-maker. Nowadays, making myths is called public relations. It's an attempt to manipulate choice, and it can have powerful impact. But it's also an acknowledgement that choice exists, that people are making their own decisions all the time. The closer you get to the principles, the more evident it is that personalities do make a difference. Politics are molded by cumulative forces involving great numbers of people, but how and when history is jolted on a given tack can depend on very few. That is the fascination of leaders, who are at once symbols representing those sweeping pressures and their active expression. Power is the great aphrodisiac, Henry Kissinger once said, but he knows how to put personality at the service of enhancing power. Margaret Thatcher put power at the service of personality, which was both her strength and her vulnerability. Ronald Reagan floated through on clouds of charm and cheer, letting others fuss about the purpose of power. George Bush, a nice man, understands the burden of power, but wants to appear a graceful floater, and he trips. Mikhail Gorbachev has used both power and personality as complementary tools, but he is floundering because the courage he showed in preparing the world for transformation of his country failed him at home. The interaction between individuals who reach the heights of command and the swelling crowds who set the direction and the limits marked this period. It brings surprises and a tremendous sense of history moving. It's no longer a faceless or even a mysterious force. It is a choice we can see being made. What a wonderful time to have been able to watch up close. I conclude writing this regular column with the feeling I've been very lucky and the wish to you to make us all a truly happy new year.
That was the New York Times' Anthony Lewis reading the last Times column of his former colleague, Flora Lewis, who died in Paris on Sunday. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Amata, John Roberts, James Roths, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is W.